I like Twit. Do you ever listen to Twit? The techie one?
No.
It's pretty good.
What is it? Is it a podcast thing?
Yeah, it's called This Week in Tech. They were like one of the originals when podcasting started. Maybe out of the mic range.
No, you're good. I'm just trying to balance it out. I know that I always get kind of hot.
You get booming?
Yeah, I get booming and passionate. Right. Well, yeah, I mean, podcasts have been around for... the Film Junk podcast that I listened to, that was the first one I started listening to, and kind of the only one I really listened to, other than a few others. Like, I listened to one called The Greatest Movie Ever, sometimes. And they're at like almost 550 episodes. They've been doing it for almost 10 years. Almost an episode a week.
Yeah, it's like the originals.
You got to just do it a lot, which I hope to start to do more often. Welcome to the Futile Podcast. Tonight, it's Dustin and Ian, and we are going to talk about doing a compare and contrast on the two science fiction films, Ex Machina and Uncanny, both of which, I think, is Ex Machina is on Amazon Prime now, but it's not on Netflix, is it?
It's on Prime Video,
Netflix. It's on Prime. If you have Amazon Prime, you can see it there. And Uncanny is on Netflix. So that is how we saw those. I saw Ex Machina. I kind of heard a little bit about it and had kind of been really waiting and anticipating and kind of excited for it. So maybe I went into it expecting more. And then this Uncanny movie comes around a little bit after. And I didn't have as high expectations. But you had seen both of them before and you kind of gave me a little heads up. I think what we got is similarity. So just to kind of lay things out. A lot of the movies now that are happening, that are these movies that are like getting limited release theatrically or no release theatrically, the Film Junk guys have a funny term for those no release ones. It used to be a much like shoddier material would be like straight to DVD, you know, straight to video, and now it's kind of like what's the VOD, video on demand? They say VOD. They call it VOD trash. Like, is this VOD trash?
You know? Is it like Netflix, their original?
Yeah. Like, well, not necessarily Netflix original intent entirely, but I mean, it's pointing to like a whole change in the atmosphere of things, because like you'll get like Transporter 18, which is ostensibly a straight to video type of movie that it gets a wide release. So the nature of what gets wide release is not necessarily speaking to quality anymore. Which I think is kind of funny. But, so you've got these independent films, quote-unquote independent. I mean, who knows what the budget is on some of these. But the technology's gotten to the point where if you're clever and if, you know, you can do pretty reasonable visual effects and, you know, you're not doing something insane. You're not doing like a Superman movie or something. And you can kind of, through, I think, a combination of practical and visual effects, pull off a halfway decent small little science fiction story. And then these are also falling into the sort of weird indie subgenre of being the like primarily one location sort of thing. Few characters, limited locations, so you can shoot it quicker. You know, you light up one space and you don't have to move to another location in 2 weeks. You don't have to pay for a lot of different locations. Everybody goes to work the whole time they're on the shoot at the same place. You know, you can leave gear there and all of that. And so both of these movies have that. They're both kind of a story, a science fiction story set in what I would say is modern or near future. I mean, does either one explicitly lay that out? Do you remember? If it's like 2017, or which would be barely future, but...
I don't think so, but the house in Ex Machina seems kind of futuristic.
Yeah, but I wonder how much of that is just this guy's so insanely loaded that... I mean, there's sci-fi technology that's kind of, that I would say, like, in terms of, like, the screens and things mm-hmm. that are in both that make you think that this is probably, like, maybe 7 or 8 or 10 or 15 or whatever. It's not too far in the future. That's not a relevant part to the story, I would say.
No, it seemed very modern, both of them.
Right, yeah. So they're both pretty much set in a modern sort of sensibility. And you've got, like, a robotics expert, or you know, genius personality type at a location working on artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And that is basically the premise for both of these movies. It's, they are very similar. Right down to, they both have that caveat of the little title cards that say like day one, day two.
Oh, they did.
They did. Right, yeah. And in the Ex Machina case, I think we'll sort of deal with the Ex Machina first and then do Uncanny and then start comparing and contrasting them. You've got that an employee of a zillionaire type recluse genius guy wins with a contest. And he gets to go spend a week hanging out with the, with this guy and his... awesome, I don't know where it is. It's probably somewhere in Canada or something. Because there's like ice that they take a helicopter to get there. There's like glaciers and
white. Yeah.
It's very cool. It's a very cool house. And the setting and location of that movie are like what probably a lot of dudes like me, loner types, are like, that would be an awesome place to live.
Right. I mean, especially from us being up in the woods like this, it's got that feel to it.
Absolutely, yeah. It's removed, and so that's where that guy lives. You know, he's got all the technology he needs so that he can still communicate and run his business, but he's basically like, if one person created Google and owned Google, like the majority of Google, that's who this made-up character is. You know, it's like a Mark Zuckerberg meets the one person that created Google kind of tech guy who did it when he was like in his teens, you know, like invented the code or something. Mm-hmm. That makes him, so he's a genius. That's how we get that. This other guy's a pretty good coder too, so he understands. They both are already in the frame of reference to what's happening. They both think kind of scientifically, a little bit cold, but kind of objectively. And
well, I think the other guy was a genius too. They said he graduated MIT at like 15 or 20.
Oh, you mean in Uncanny? Yeah. At 20 in Uncanny, that was the thing. It's the exact same premise. It's, like I said, it's the loner genius with enough resources to do whatever they want to working on AI, and then so in the case of Ex Machina, this employee comes in with this this kind of sense of like, oh, you're gonna hang out in my awesome house with me for a week and you know, like whatever. But it turns out that what he actually wants him to do is be like a test subject to help, you know. And so, I'll just lay this out, you know, generally on the podcast, we go ahead and we do spoilers. I think maybe we can try to avoid the major spoilers towards like the end of our discussion, so that way people that haven't seen the movies can listen to a portion of it, and if they're interested, they can pause and then they can go watch the movies on Netflix or Prime. Okay. And then come back and catch the end. So I'll try to leave like maybe whatever happens in like the last third of both movies, and I'll probably be the one that will accidentally do this. But just so everyone knows, you know, we're going to spoil stuff, but we'll try to keep it at the end. Primarily, we're just going to sort of talk about stuff that isn't such a big, you know, that you get revealed to you pretty quickly, or can kind of already tell. So this guy goes to this guy's house, you know, up in and the guy's like, here, sign an NDA, you know, non-disclosure agreement. I'll show you something really cool. And it's that he's basically going to interact with a robot, an artificial intelligence robot. It's like half, got like a humanoid form and like some kind of artificial skin or something over the face. But primarily looks like it just sort of a very stripped down kind of like arms and a torso, like almost like a mannequin, really.
Right.
With like a human female face and voice and...
But you definitely know that it's a robot.
Yeah. There's no mystery there. Right. They're like, this is a robot. Or at least it seems like it's a robot. You know, you're always... I mean, with these movies, you're always kind of waiting for... what's the twist? And that can, we can talk later when we get into the spoilery stuff and everything about both of them, like as to whether that benefits or hurts them. I think sometimes in terms of like this weird subgenre of like not too far off sci-fi type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So he arrives there and then just ends up doing experiment. He's part of an experiment essentially, which takes about the course of a week. So in Uncanny, this woman is a journalist and she's for a magazine but was a former robotics person and you know bailed out on her thesis paper and went and did video games and made a good bit of money doing that and is kind of just staying like keeps her toes in the water of what's going on with the new stuff by being a journalist, I guess.
A tech journalist. Yeah.
And they get into that more with the character stuff. So she's there to basically just do an article. and it's much more upfront, I'd say, at least initially.
Right.
It's a different kind of location. It's set in the city. It's basically like a building, like a floor of a building almost, that's got, you know, that's locked down. You know, you need codes to enter and exit, and there's like cameras to let, you know, security and all that. But there's really no one else there. There's just this guy who you learn pretty quickly was like, you know, one of those genius types and graduated from MIT and all that stuff. And he's been granted through, I guess it's just a corporation.
Yeah, he's an employee.
Yeah, he's an employee of this guy named Castle, played by Rainn Wilson, who's like the known actor in the movie that you'd recognize. You've seen like The Office and stuff. And he's in it at the beginning looking ominous and saying nothing, and then he's in it at the very end.
For like a minute or two.
Yeah. Yeah, they shot with him for maybe 2 hours, probably. And so the interactions are starting from different places. In one case, you've got that it's an employee-employer, and it's kind of like this guy's kind of eccentric, you know? He's got the shaved head, but he's got the beard. He's, you know, exercising. They established that he's drinking a lot, you know? Because he's like, oh, I always like to, you know, he's hitting a punching bag. He's like, I exercise a lot when I'm hungover to kind of reset my system or something. And, so that's that situation. And then you've got this sort of journalist investigating with this guy who's a little strange, and he's almost kind of robotic. And then you're presented with, pretty quickly, with this other guy who just looks like a person, and then you're told that's, you know, I mean, you're shown some technology much quicker, I'd say, in Uncanny than you are in Ex Machina. And I think they actually get more into, you know, sci-fi technology.
Yeah, stuff. It shows them fingers and
hands. Yeah, and eyes, and right. And later on they get into and even the skin and stuff.
And then he says this is a product of
all
these inventions. Yeah.
Exactly. And then we meet the guy, Adam. Of course, he's called Adam, you know, the first man, the first robot, or first AI, or whatever. Not terribly clever, but whatever. I mean, right. I think that when you get to the end of it, you can see an extra sort of convolution there, and that's probably why it's just a placeholder name. And so you're like, okay, so this guy's like full-on like robot AI. There's not as much budget there for them to do a lot of visual effects. It's mostly practical. I mean, they have some screens and some things that they do at some point in Uncanny.
Yeah, and I'm sure those hands, you know, were
and some,
cheap to come up with.
No, I'm not saying cheap, but those were practical effects, which is kind of makes it better because it grounds them. Somebody sat there and tinkered and built like a little robotic hand and built like, you know, the little eye and all of those things. And so that's kind of cool. As opposed to Ex Machina, where I think it relies a little more on visual effects, certainly for like the female, you know,
CGI
mannequin body is what I'll call it, which later on she starts to put on clothes and hair, and it becomes almost like this sort of seduction thing she starts doing. She starts to take on the role of what I would say is sort of almost like a femme fatale. She wants something. She's, if you get kind of broad strokes with it, it's like she's a woman, but she's a robot.
Right.
But she's under duress and under control by this man, and she's trying to use this other man.
A single man.
Yeah, to maybe help get her out of that situation. And that's kind of what the plot ends up being, because he, in Ex Machina, because he ends up talking with her and slowly developing sort of a compassion for her situation. It's very clear that there's, you know, that not everything is what it seems, and there's these power outages that happen because the guy's completely off the grid. He's up in the, you know, in the lush wilderness of Canada or somewhere like that. And so when these power outages happen, it's like the robot Eve, was she called Eve?
I think so.
Oh my God. Okay, fine. Eve. Right. Eve will say things to the kid, the character whose name I don't remember.
Yeah.
The employee, whatever. Yeah.
He said, look like Mark Zuckerberg.
Well, a little bit does. General Hux from the new Star Wars. She'll say things like, don't trust him, don't whatever. So it pretty quickly starts to turn in. I mean, from Ex Machina, I get a sort of ominous thriller feeling
right
fairly early in the movie.
And also, they're secluded out in the woods.
Right.
And he can't leave.
Right.
It's almost like once he goes in, he's stuck in this place. To where Uncanny, the reporter, she can come and go as she pleases. So it's in a city, almost seems like a flat that right. they're in. There is a sense of seclusion once she comes in there, but then she's also free to leave. So actually, when I was watching the movie, I kind of felt a sense of relief when things started to get hairy, mm-hmm. and then she just kind of goes home, and then, you know, you're like, okay, she's safe, you know, now for a while. To whereas the Ex Machina, as the story progresses, you kind of feel claustrophobic in the movie.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he can't leave, and he's in his room, and it seems like everything's being watched. And so from those two things, yeah, you definitely, there's a thriller, psychological thriller thing going on.
Definitely, yeah. And that probably appeals to more people. I mean, it appeals to me, too. I mean, I think it works there. I forget. So when the power does weird stuff in the house, does it go? Everything goes on lockdown?
Yeah, it goes on lockdown. The lights go red.
Right, yeah.
So you almost
get, you were like, extra trapped right. when the power glitches out.
Right.
And that becomes important later. Right, I mean, so it's one of those weird things where, because it's like, you don't know how sane this guy is. I mean, just being alone and being so wealthy as he is, you know he's going to be a weirdo. Like, you just don't know if he's dangerous.
Well, first you don't even know why the power glitches happen.
They then there's the power glitches too, yeah.
Right, they just happen, and then I think he gets locked in his room.
Yeah, the first one, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know that somebody's doing some weird stuff, you don't know what it is, or,
right.
yeah, if they're out in the woods and you are kind of a victim of your circumstances.
Exactly. So that's good. That's interesting stuff. But I mean, but pretty quickly it kind of, I'd say, picks its genre. And its genre is almost sci-fi horror thriller, because you've got the claustrophobia. You've got the, I mean, maybe horror is the wrong word. I think thriller is good, because it's definitely turns into that, where you're just like, you're, like you said, you don't get that relief. That tension kind of keeps going with the movie. And so then if you're comfortable enough with that as a genre, you can kind of start to see where things are going to go, maybe, or at least see certain avenues, like either this guy's going to go more nuts and that, or something else and this. And then, but then you, without kind of making a large, any real notice of it, you see that there's this Asian woman there too, that's kind of like,
oh, the servant.
The servant, yeah. Yes. And it's really weird. It's like she doesn't speak English, mate, you know, and the guy, and the one guy who seems kind of cool, the eccentric boss dude, is kind of, he's like demeaning to her, and he's really kind of, it's kind of embarrassing, and like, right. you know, and you're like, wow. And then she doesn't say anything, and she just kind of does her own thing, sort of, but is always around him, but then isn't. And she's like, well, that's weird. I guess he just, like, hired, like, a... I mean, it's believable that some crazy guy might just, you know, get a mail order,
that's whatever. What I thought, yeah.
Yeah, and then just keeps her around for, you know, whatever reasons. And that's kind of gross. And that certainly, like, makes... That's, like, all of the stuff with her, once she's introduced and everything, starts to color his character in a certain way. Like, where you're like, okay, this guy's not really a cool guy. He's you know, indulging in certain kinds of mentality and behavior that shows he's a little bit... He's definitely removed from general right. civil society.
Yeah, I think he yells at the kid once or twice, or
yeah,
has some bad behavioral problems. And then, yeah, when the Asian lady, she drops something, he demands that she picks it up and
yeah.
punishes her or something
yeah,
like
that. Yeah, he gets mad about weird. That, and it's sort of like... But then later, you kind of, as the twists keep going, you sort of see maybe that he's more upset at himself in a strange way, possibly. Mm-hmm. So, let's see, it's kind of, we were going bouncing back and forth kind of as we get through the plots of both of them. But I would say, and I don't want to do much more with the plot, I think I want to really get into the meat and potatoes of discussing what we think about the stories. That, yeah, they both, I mean, Uncanny become, is a little more, it's more talky at the beginning especially. It's more tech, I think. So maybe it's a little smarter in that respect. It's lower fi. It's not as well shot, but it looks fine. It's just, to me, it had kind of a, like, drab blue-green quality almost throughout the whole thing that I felt was just kind of not always the right color palette for it or something. Like, even I think when they go outside up on the roof of the building, there isn't, like, much of it. That would have been a good time to, like, change it, warm it up a little bit, you know? Right. More orange or something, because it was, like, sunset, or not quite sunset, but it was, you know, late afternoon. So that was a little dry. Like, I mean, I think framing-wise, it looked good. I think they both frame up really well. Mm-hmm. I mean, that house in Ex Machina is just, like, you know, Architectural Digest, why not, you know? Just, like, place the camera in the corner with a wide-angle lens and just depth of field all day and look at the structure and the
lots of lights yeah. change in the rooms, and he has the key cards to go everywhere, so some things are off limits and some things aren't,
right? So. Yeah, I mean, so it was definitely a maze quality to that, and they didn't really explore that in Uncanny in terms of the, like you said, it seemed like it was like a flat, it was just like a one whole story of a building in what seemed like a Los Angeles type city.
Yeah.
That just had a few rooms, but for the most part was just, you know, that. There was no real restriction or anything, so people would, you know, there would be times when one of the characters would be, you know, Adam would be working on something, and the reporter would just be up, show up behind him, and he'd be like, oh, hi, you know?
Yeah, and they'd also work independently of each other.
Yeah.
Adam would be developing stuff, and then, what was it? Was that Brian or something, or...
I don't
remember. But he would be doing other things. Yeah. So it was a lot more free-flowing to where Ex Machina, they had her behind glass. She had this, you know, that she was dangerous or something like that.
She was kept.
Right. And then, like, a study.
Yeah.
But Uncanny, there was just, free-floating.
Yeah.
You know, they were still in this room they couldn't leave, but for the most part, their interactions were a little more unique.
Yeah, I would agree, because it wasn't just like ask these questions or do this, or the, you know, between glass, and then the rest of the time is just kind of hanging out with this guy and feeling out how it's going to go, and it's like a cabin in the woods.
Yeah, they're playing chess
thriller sort of thing. Well, yeah, no, exactly. Well, in Ex Machina, but then in Uncanny, yeah, they're playing chess. Yeah. So the interactions are, I think, much more. They are more unique. Yeah. So I mean, let's get into it. Let's pull it off. Pull off the edge of the situation, and we'll talk spoiler free or whatever, not spoiler free, but spoilerific, and get into the different things of it. So, I mean, I think ultimately, now we're just looking at my Letterboxd scores, and my Letterboxd score for Ex Machina was higher than my Letterboxd score for Uncanny, which I watched Uncanny last night. I watched Ex Machina like 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
And I think it might have been, I mean, these are always your initial. I do, when I do my Letterboxd and I do my little 2-sentence reviews, it's almost, I do that like right as the credits are rolling of the movie. So it's my instant take on things. I don't let it marinate for a day. I don't forget, you know, while I always forget anything. It's just like here's my 2 cents, my 2 sentences. Here's my star rating. And I've started using the like. They have a little heart thing that you can click too. So it's like, so maybe you give a movie like a 3, but then you give it a heart if like, I really like this, but they didn't really execute everything really well. Okay. Like, I think I did that with Uncanny. I think I gave it like a 3 and gave it a heart. I think, I don't know if I gave Ex Machina a heart. But anyway, but so all that sort of weird half-assed equivocation of, you know, qualifying and quantifying. I think, I mean, when you told me about Uncanny, which I had added to my queue earlier, and said, like, it's like a better story of Ex Machina, but it's, you know, sort of lower-fi, it's cheaper in execution. And I would agree. Like I said earlier, talking about the look being kind of... There's nothing wrong with the way it's shot. It's just shot in a fairly... Like, there's not a lot of versatility in the look. I mean, with Ex Machina, they go outside sometimes, so there's these landscapes that are beautiful. I mean, it's got more money, so it's just... It can do more. Mm-hmm. It's just higher budget, so it's higher fi, you know. That said, I think prefer the more hands-on practical effecty stuff that you're getting in Uncanny to the sort of hand wave stuff. I mean, you get very little with the practical stuff. You know, he explains like, oh, this is the brain, you know, it does this and this. So it's not as much into the technical stuff as it is into being the thriller. You know, like creepy music manipulation and stuff. I want to say that I don't remember. I mean, Uncanny has some of that sort of generic sci-fi, like ning-ning-ning-ning-ning-ning, you know, type, you know, someone doing stuff on a keyboard kind of thing. But for the most part, I don't feel like the music was like doing that, like make you feel eerie, creepy thing that I think Ex Machina did a little more, you know, like in those quieter moments.
Yeah, I think Ex Machina definitely had like a thriller or a horror or a suspenseful feel to it, where this one was, like I said before, more casual.
Yeah.
You didn't know. I mean, Ex Machina, you kind of had a feeling that she's dangerous and she's something's going to happen. And she, either the guy's going to go crazy and kill a bunch of people, or she's going to go crazy and kill a bunch of people. But in Uncanny, it was more like... I didn't have that feeling. It didn't leave me anxious.
Right. Well, you had those moments of relief at times, like you said. And then everything was, for the most part, still fairly casual. And you have... There's no glass. There's no block. There's no sense that something's being kept, you know, in a certain place. I mean, the whole floor is locked down, mm-hmm. but the AI is free to interact with people, almost like a person. It's like a roommate or something.
Was scared of him. Adam would come in the guy's room and he was sleeping and wake him up and they'd have conversations.
Right.
It was more free. You know, you felt like you were kind of in the room with them and everybody was getting along. The character, the lady, though, she definitely had a weird feel to Adam versus the inventor guy. I'll call him Brian because I don't remember what his name is.
Yeah, right.
So she did treat Brian with more respect than she treated the AI guy, which I guess if I was around an AI thing, I would too. You know, you treat like a kid or a...
you wouldn't know how to treat it in a lot of ways. And that's where it becomes an interesting... I mean, once we do full spoilers on that, I think we can get into some much more interesting sort of subtextual stuff that's going on in that movie. Here's all I can think of. I think Ex Machina had more money. Ex Machina, maybe because it had more money, had more of an obligation to try to hit a bigger target of an audience. Mm-hmm. So by being more like, this is a thriller... and less, like you said, casual, which I think is a great word. A movie that doesn't have to insist on being so much of a certain genre. Like, it's a little more like, I mean, if you don't mind them having some conversations about this or that. Though, I mean, let's not short sell the fact. I mean, Uncanny is essentially the same kind of story. It's also a thriller, I would say. Yeah. It just takes it a little easier. And it's a little less blunt about it, maybe. You don't have the interaction between the glass indicating that something's already kind of off and sad. And you don't have the music, I would say. And the seclusion and the claustrophobia as much. I think I agree with you. I think I prefer that. I think that's in the plus column for it. Though I can see where it could be in the minus column for a lot of people. Because they're like, I'm not really sure what this movie's trying to be. It's totally inconsistent or something. It's not like it becomes a comedy at any point. But it's just much more... It's less insistent on being a thriller,
right?
The whole time, at least. And I like that about it. I mean, it's let's hit on something that's also pretty important to both of us, and I think to a lot of people that watch a lot of movies, or if they watch very few movies, it's like an 82-minute runtime.
Yes. that's my biggest thing.
That's huge. This is, we're talking about... I gotta keep saying it, otherwise people will be confused. Which one are we talking about? Talking about Uncanny, 82-minute runtime.
Right.
Ex Machina, I do not remember. I want to say it's over 2 hours.
At least.
It's like 2 hours and 10 minutes right. or something. Now, some of that, it's slower and paced with the tension and the building. But there's a handful of, you know, it could have been 20 minutes shorter. You know, there's a couple of times where it's like he's having a similar interaction with the boss again. That's not a lot of new information getting learned there, and not a lot of character development or anything is happening. It's just like, oh, okay, yeah, we get that the boss likes to drink, and so now he's going to do this one little thing. And I feel like, yeah, so.
Yeah, I don't know why directors or writers insist on two-hour movies.
Yeah.
If you can convey a story in 80 or 90 minutes, just keep it that way.
That's what they used to do in the 80s, man, in the heyday of cinema, right? In the 80s, so much stuff is it hits that sweet spot of being at least less than 2 hours. Like 110 minutes is only 10 minutes less than 2 hours, but that's infinitely shorter than 127 minutes.
It counts as a long time.
Yeah.
So I thought Uncanny was long enough.
Yeah, and you know what? I don't remember it feeling short. And it does have similar interactions. I mean, both of these are hitting the same beats in a lot of ways. Uncanny just hits the beats in a different rhythm, I guess. And so it's weird because it's a movie that feels full, but doesn't feel bridged to me. It almost feels kind of long too, because of those repetitions, I think, which, I mean, I think those are necessary for both the films. You need like, oh, this is their first meeting and this happens. This is their second meeting and this happens. And it has to be a little gradual, otherwise it's too extreme. Right. And I don't feel like either one of them ever just jumps the shark into being too extreme. Actually, oddly enough, if one does feel like it becomes, like it switches gears pretty quickly or too quickly, a little abruptly, I would say it's actually Ex Machina, which is longer, where it just feels like, maybe because it lets things settle a few times, you're like, okay, what's that? So, the California Anthem in the background.
Well, they had weird stuff in there too, like the dance scene with the Asian lady.
Yeah, right. There was some quote-unquote self-indulgent scenes that were like, what is this really doing, or how is this...
Like, you already know the guy's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't need to have like this weird like red light dance. And I think the power goes out when they're doing that.
Yeah.
And so there was some really bizarre stuff in Ex Machina.
Yeah, there was. And I mean, I think part of that was obviously, I mean, you get the justification for all of it, and you just don't know if you needed it. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, oh, it's to convey a little more creepiness, a little more like, what's going on here, man? You know? I mean, so really just hitting at the end points of it. So now we're going to go full spoilers. So, and let's do Ex Machina first, and then we'll get into Uncanny. So, the guy is essentially seduced by the female robot.
Before you do that, I don't know if he was seduced or he, like you said earlier, was just sympathetic.
Yeah, well, it started that way.
Right, because I didn't feel a real connection between him and her.
Right, no, I agree with you there. There's not like a real romance there, but there is this kind of weird, idealized... I mean, he's seduced, but he's aware of it. And he even brings it up to the boss, where he's like, so did you, like... I mean, when he realizes that he's not just a guy that won a contest, that he was, like, very specifically chosen for a handful of different reasons.
No family, yeah. Single...
Yeah, seems like a good guy, has a good moral compass, all these things. And so then it's like, you know, and then he asks the other guy bluntly, like, when you made her face, like, did you, like, scan my porn profile?
Right, right. That's
so, like, you know, like, kind of what turns me on. I mean, and so it gets into that, the sort of creepy side of things a little, too. And at some point, yeah, he definitely, he's like, look, I'm going to help you. I'm going to help you escape this guy. And, you know, he steals the key card. He gets the boss drunk and steals the key card and does some reprogramming.
Well, and the reason the blackouts are happening is because she's causing them. She sends a shockwave through the electrical system or something.
Yeah, sense how she's charged or something.
Yeah, and then they communicate discreetly where the guy can't see.
Yeah, but you don't know a lot of the time if those are part of the experiment. At first, you don't know if that's like, maybe the guy's doing that. Maybe the boss is doing that to, you know, see how they'll react differently if they don't think he's watching them.
But she explains that she explains
later that that's her, but then you still, like, the whole time you're wondering, what's the extra convolution? What's the extra loop? You know, is she even a robot? You wonder at some. I did, because it's like, so it's upfront from the beginning. It's made abundantly clear. And then she does the thing where she sort of transitions herself and puts her hair on and puts clothes on and essentially just looks like a normal girl.
Yeah, you wonder who's screwing who.
Yeah, exactly. you wondering what is this all about? Like, is this going to be... You just start playing. It becomes tricky because it's hard to stay completely in a movie when you're trying to so hard to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know if, like, that's like... I mean, like, I did that. I don't know if you did that as much. I mean, if that's just a general audience. If people are doing that, or people like us would do that, and that's on us, you know? It's like, well, it's not the movie's fault for having twists. And it's our fault for trying to figure them out ahead of time, you know?
No, I think they wanted you to.
Yeah.
I think there was enough confusion.
Right.
They wanted you, because at one point he goes into her space and talks to her.
Yeah.
And they're having a little conversation.
The boss does, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the kid watches him on TV.
But he can't hear him, but he sees what happens, yeah.
And the boss is going there to plant a camera so he can see what happens when the power goes out.
Yeah, a little remote camera. Right. But he also rips up a picture she drew of the guy to make it seem like maybe there's some weird jealousy or something else going on. So, I mean, I would say, and then a lot of these things I think don't get resolved for me in a purely satisfying way, and that's not necessarily always a problem, but in this case I feel like there's enough levels of like conflict and convolution going on that it's like it's the end of the day, I'm never really fully clear what the boss's intentions were with the whole series of experiments. If it was, I think you get that it's like this sort of twisted thing where it's like he wanted to see if he would pick a machine, if the employee would pick a machine over his boss, over a human being, and betray his you know, a human being for the sake of a machine. You know, if he would have, if he would be so invested in this artificial intelligence, care so much about it, that he would be willing to put, you know, his livelihood and maybe even his life at risk to help it.
Right.
And I think so, that's what you get. That's maybe the goal. You know, the boss has been drinking a lot, and you know that there's something, he's having tough times dealing with the ethics of all of this on some level. And you're like, okay, I get that a bit. But then later you see this big reveal when the employee has got the boss's key card and he's in the boss's computer and he sees all these old videos. And you're like, This isn't the first robot.
No.
Eve, ironically enough, is not the first, you know, female robot this guy built. And then you realize that this Asian woman is actually like Mark 7 or like, I don't know what, a version of the first one he built. And it was him, it was the boss originally, having these through glass interactions, watching the robot go crazy, get stir crazy, bash its arms off, some kind of upsetting, disturbing stuff. You get that and you're like, okay, that adds an extra level to it. I mean, he's already had one that's been to that point, but then I guess he felt safe enough to let it out. You don't ever get a sense of that he's tamed it or put in some kind of restrictive control mechanism, you know? It doesn't have a restraining bolt on it or anything.
I think maybe it was just dumber. Or maybe this new one was a little more advanced cognitively.
Right, yeah. That's possible. But obviously, it's learned and it kind of becomes part of the conspiracy for the escape for the other one.
Yeah, but was it just following directions from the other one? Or
I don't know that it was, because it seemed like it kind of took the lead. Because okay. So the employee lets the, you know, switches everything around on the boss so that way the next time the power goes out, it's everything locking down, it opens everything, which lets the Eve out. And so then she's free to do whatever she wants, and she starts, because she wants to leave.
Uh-huh.
She doesn't want to be captive anymore, wants to feel the sun on her face or whatever, like, you know, she tells to the guy. And so then the boss is like flipping out about it, you know, because of what's going on. And then the other robot, the Asian one, stabs him, and he's like, he can't believe it. And then he gets killed. And he's the whole time, the last line is like unfucking real. Like, he just doesn't understand what's even happening. He's so removed from, he probably doesn't think he's mortal or something, because just being a bazillionaire and doing whatever. He's played God all this time by himself.
Well, and that guy outsmarted him. I don't think he was prepared for that.
No, he wasn't. And that was a little incredulous, too, because you felt like he had so much control. But even though he was drinking and stuff, it was like, did he let himself pretend to get drunk? You always wonder what's still the experiment and when is it not. And I feel like the plot kind of becomes a little more generic towards the last half or the last third, when it just kind of, oh yeah, I guess he actually did let himself, he did get drunk and he was asleep and the other guy got in, but then, oh, he's been listening to them, so he knows that they've, but then it gets extinguished really quickly. It's like, I know that you actually were conspiring with her. And then he's like, well, did you know that when you got drunk that time, you know,
he already did it all.
Yeah, I had changed the lockdown procedure. And it's like, well, you think if he knew that he had betrayed him, he would have gone through and looked at his lockdown procedure. You know, I don't know. The plot hole things start to happen more, I would say. And when we'll get to the other one, we'll see where those lie. And so the girl, Eve, the robot, comes to the guy after and says, you know, just stay here or something. Almost like, you know, just be cool. Be here. And then she bounces, and then the place locks back down again, and the guy's stuck there. And it seems really horrific for a minute. Like, oh my God, this guy's going to die in this house where, I mean, there's food, there's water, whatever. I mean, you don't know how much he can walk around, but you get a sense that he can do a little bit of it.
Well, he nullified his card.
Right.
So I think he was confined in that room until he died.
Oh, that's possible. I wasn't sure that I got that it was just the room, or if he had just couldn't get out. But
no, because remember, he disabled the main guy's car, right. So that's why he couldn't escape from Eve. He couldn't leave that room, and then they went over there and killed him.
Yeah, right. Well, no, I don't know. I think he got knocked out, and then he wasn't even aware of them killing him, I don't think. I think later on he was.
But one thing I really liked about when she, right before she left, but also kind of thought they took too far, was when she spent all that time taking all the skin off the old robots.
Yeah.
And you could, the whole point was that she just wanted to be a normal person.
Yeah.
Like, she thought that she had got to the point where, I'm just going to wear some skin, put on a dress, and go live in the real world.
Right. And and so the helicopter arrived because the 7 days were up, blah, blah, blah. And that all timed out for her to then just go out and meet with the helicopter. And the helicopter guy's kind of just used to probably doing whatever and maybe thinks this is just some call girl or something that the boss called in. So he's like, okay, I guess you're the one that I'm taking. So that's believable. I don't have an issue with that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they get into how she charges and keeps your batteries going, so you don't know how she's going to just drop dead, you know, 2 days after being in the real world or what. But you know, but the kind of horror conceit at the end there is that this is a robot that has effectively manipulated people into doing her bidding or whatever, and now she's out in the world and essentially, for all intents and purposes, is invisible, you know.
Or kills to get away, you know?
Well, but I mean, in the sense that, like, how do you find her? I mean, I guess if you know what she looks like. I mean, it all falls apart pretty quick because it's like, how long before that boss guy doesn't talk to some guy about that he has a meeting with before people get worried and somebody, you know, flies another helicopter up there? I mean, you don't know. It might be a week, it might not. Now, whether or not it'll be long enough for that other guy to starve to death, if he's locked in one room, if it's over a week, I mean, you know, he dehydrates and that's a miserable way to die. And you're like, wow, why did she have to do that to him? I guess she just chose not to trust humanity. It becomes fairly cynical at that point, you know?
Right. So it was good.
Yeah, no, it was good.
It was good overall.
And for what it was, it definitely became more of a horror, like a thriller, and that's what it was. And it kind of didn't do anything terribly surprising at the end, and it didn't really, I would say, thematically or subtextually give you much more than you kind of were probably going to expect going into it, which is like, this is going to be a story about like the uncanny, quality of the artificial intelligence and choosing that over, you know, maybe a human that's a jerk, you know? And what that says. I don't feel they got too much into things like maybe gender stuff, which they could have done a little more with, maybe. I mean, it's there, but you'd have to really want to make a point of it, you know, with the way the guy treats the, you know, servant Asian robot he made, and then the way the other guy treats and kind of covets this gentle Eve robot that he's, you know, got like a weird, maybe got like a weird fetish thing going on with.
But I think it was more sexual than it was that they were connected.
Yeah, there was no like emotional, not a lot of it at least, because he kept it pretty dry and objective, but then still ultimately had a, you know, sort of human compassion to help her.
And her movements were jerky, like she looked like a robot.
Yeah, she had those movements.
She had really no like precise movements.
Yeah.
She didn't have And Uncanny, too, I don't know if you know, but Uncanny Valley, have you heard of that?
Yeah, the term.
That's where artificial intelligence doesn't quite look like human.
Right.
So she kind of had that Uncanny Valley part to her.
Right. Yeah, I think the example I've heard for the Uncanny Valley used a lot is with video games and they get closer with the graphics. Uh-huh. So in most cases, of like if it's very cartoony, it's more, it's not necessarily more believable, maybe it's easier to buy into it, but then when you get closer and closer, you get more and more critical of it, I think. And
right. It's
like, that looks like a really ugly mutant version of a human, as opposed to, that just looks like a cartoon version of a human.
Right, and from what I understand, I think it's an eye thing.
I think that has a lot to do with it.
When you look in the eyes, the way that the eyes react. That Snow Christmas Train movie was one of the worst ones because the people looked really real.
Right.
But their eyes were something.
All the motion capture stuff that Zemeckis has done. Yeah, Polar Express
is
that. And then later on, he did the one for Scrooge. He did like two of those Christmas motion capture animations.
So that's what I liked about the movie Uncanny was they used a real person.
Yeah.
And they didn't try to make him robotic at all.
Right.
So at times, the only way you could tell that he was a robot maybe was his behaviors.
It was absolutely that.
Right.
And the weirdness was, and they started hitting this immediately, so at least you're thinking about it. You're going into this, especially, I mean, like, we both saw Ex Machina first, so we're going into this like, okay, this is the poor man's Ex Machina, maybe it will surprise us. So maybe our expectations were a little lower, so being fully honest with ourselves, maybe if it exceeded our lower expectations, as opposed to Ex Machina kind of maybe not quite hitting our higher expectations, there's this weird kind of, you know, shift in terms of how we ultimately assess it. Uh-huh. But you get a fairly robotic performance. I mean, you know, and it is, you know, I mean, I don't know any of these actors. I don't know if I've seen any of them in much else. I don't think that they do a poor job with their performance. It's very hard to play a robot, right, and have it work authentically.
Right.
And so I think that the performances, I think the actors do a pretty good job for the most part.
Yeah, I thought the... And also, one of the guys is pretty much socially retarded.
Yeah.
So it's almost like there's two robots in there.
Yeah.
Because the guy has trouble interacting with the reporter, and then the Adam, he doesn't quite understand things. So
right,
there's this kind of this disconnect where they're...
Yeah, they're immediately addressing this sort of subtextual thing that I think becomes thematic throughout the movie, of this like extra element, which is, so it's got the thriller thing, but it's also got the, you know, sort of almost rom-com-y thing of like the cute, nice girl with the socially awkward guy, and will she kind of help him learn to open up and, you know, fall in love and blah, blah, blah. And I mean, that's not like hardcore in the story, that's an element of the story, and it happens, I think, in a fairly believable, naturalistic way. You get at the very beginning the guy with the glasses, the boss, or not the boss, but the Brian, right? We'll call him Brian because we don't remember and we're not going to waste a bunch of time looking it up right now. You get that he is he seems very robotic. He seems like, so you're like, has this guy's got like a social, like, you know, he's like a malady, maybe, you know, he's maybe he's a little autistic, a little Asperger's, whatever, you know.
Is he? Yes.
Yeah. And so, because you're already thinking about that idea, you know, or maybe he's the robot and the other guy isn't, or maybe they're both robots, you know. You're playing all these games with the twists. And then fairly quickly, I would say, he starts to warm up. He starts to make... You get a sense that he's got a deadpan sense of humor. But even before that sense of humor, you get sort of an arrogance from him. And so, the way he treats Adam and stuff. Like with the chess game, where then later on, he beats Adam with the chess game. And he says, I was willing to sacrifice my queen. You got to learn to, like, there's, you know, your goal in chess is to win the game, so don't be so precious about, you know, certain things. And then he leaves, and then Adam sits there and looks at it for a minute, and then gets a little indignant.
Right.
And it's like, he had me beat six moves ago doing this other thing. He didn't have to do any of that. He didn't have to lose the queen. He didn't have to...
He didn't understand that he wasn't focused on the prime objective of winning the game.
Yeah, he's like, the guy's being a hypocrite, you know? Right. And so he's questioning that. And sort of trying to, and then he asks the reporter, you know, trying to get a sense of like, well, and she's like, well, maybe that was part of the test. You know, once again, mm-hmm. he's become, so she's really observing the interaction between the creator and the AI as her job as a reporter. That's what she's there to be doing. It's not that she's part of the experiment necessarily, like in Ex Machina.
Yeah, they want her to write a really good report in the paper or news.
It's probably, yeah, some tech magazine, I don't know.
And his name's David. I looked it up.
No, it's David. Okay.
David's the main guy.
Right, yeah. That makes sense now. So David is... So you start to pretty quickly see that, like, David has a dry sense of humor. He starts to kind of warm her up to him through, like, fairly believable kind of socially awkward nerd charm. And you right. establish that she's kind of a nerd girl, too. Maybe not realistically, you know, because she's a very attractive woman, and that's not usually the way it goes, but... That's maybe a sexist statement. I don't know. Everything is, you know, blown open now. There's plenty of pretty people in every right, industry, right. whatever, who cares? You know, the too beautiful to be a scientist thing maybe doesn't actually, maybe isn't true anymore.
I hope not.
Yeah, right? But we all. You get that from, about her character, you get some from her character. Now, a lot of this is sort of exposition-y, but I think it's the telling, but it's showing in the way the characters behave, too. You know, you don't have a lot you can do. There are people talking in a couple different rooms. Both movies are people talking in a couple different rooms.
Right.
There's just, it's just a little flashier and with a little more money in Ex Machina. And so in Uncanny, you learn of this stuff we already said about how she used to be into robotics and she kind of gave up on her. You don't really ever get a sense of why, but you get a sense of disappointment from her. Like, she could have wanted to change the world. Maybe she still could, but now she feels like she's missed the boat on it.
Well, he kind of rubs it in because he's kind of a, like you said, arrogant.
Yeah, he is. He yeah. is arrogant with her about it. And then Adam is the same way, but he's more like coming from a place of curiosity. Like,
right,
why
right.
wouldn't you want to do this? And so then the, you know, David you know, she shows up one day and he's like, look, I set up the thing for your experiment that she did. And he kind of sort of woos her through these nerd-like ways, mm-hmm. you know, and she's, you know, she's flattered by it and all of that. And you start to see that it's like this, two humans are invariably going to kind of bond over humanistic things, while the robot is going to be kind of removed and alienated. And that starts to affect the way the robot behaves with her and with, her name is Joy, with Joy, mm-hmm. and with David. And it becomes almost like a love triangle. And it happens pretty quickly. And you get a sense of that it could happen fairly quickly too, because, you know, Adam asks David, he's like, do you think she's pretty? And David gives a very stock, almost robotic answer, right. about the symmetry of her face, right. and, you know, all of that. And then and he says, yeah, I suppose, you know. And then Adam says, well, I think she's very pretty, you know. Like, he qualifies it.
Right.
So you start putting all these little breadcrumbs, you know, of, like, the way Adam says things, the way Adam does things versus the way that David does things. And the whole time you're like, well, I mean, David is clearly socially awkward. Not necessarily even awkward, but he's got, like, a certain kind of almost pathology, but it's minor, but like maybe a little bit of a sociology thing there. Not sociology, so sociopath kind of thing going on. Because the things he's doing with Joy are somewhat manipulative, you know? Like, he's got this information about her, and then he's kind of, you know, he's charming her. He's warming up to her, you know? Right. He wants to get with her, and so he does those kinds of things and plays it pretty well, and it ends up working out.
And you can see the tension building, because Adam is actually the one that spots all these things.
Yeah.
And then David kind of takes it and uses it to manipulate
it. It's like a Cyrano kind of thing. Right. It's like, well, oh, she feels bad about not finishing her dissertation. Well, maybe I'm going to build. And then Adam's like, I helped set that up.
Right,
and
right.
He's not saying that I did it. Yeah, so you get all the love triangle, like, acrimony stuff happening. Yeah. And it happens in a way that I feel is fairly authentic and believable. That the relationship developing between Joy and David feels reasonable enough. I mean, it maybe gets a little more... I mean, it doesn't have a lot of time. It's been 7 days. And in those 7 days, by the end of it, things go to the point that they go to, you know. And they kind of, you know, he makes her dinner and tells a story about watching a Japanese...
Well, I like, because she leaves and then they have their interaction.
Yeah.
That David and Adam do.
Yeah.
I like it so that Adam would come into the room and ask David some questions, and then David would be like, you know, this is why we talk. And, like, yeah. there's a learning thing going on.
Yeah.
He's trying to understand it. So I like that there's the three of them that interact, and then how just the two of them interact.
Yeah, and there's always... But that kind of plays itself out. Like, you know, then you get the other two. Then you get the other two. You get Joy and David. You get... Joy and Adam, you get Adam and David, and, you know, see, so at each one there's different information, and different, those interactions are sort of different,
mm-hmm.
as they're supposed to be. They're trying to get different things out of each other. And so you're like, okay, well, you're told that Adam is the, you know, is the robot, and so his behaviors are, you're like, okay, is he becoming, you know, at a certain point you get a sense like he's becoming kind of creepy obsessive with Joy. He starts behaving in weird ways. He gives her an eye and uses it to spy on her, which is like, you know, he says, oh, this is just, it's non-proprietary technology. It's just an old piece of junk. He says, it's like a paperweight, but, you know, it's a memento for the time we had. I want you to have it. And so you're like, okay, so he's going full on, like, obsessive, creepy guy, but as a robot. Yeah.
The Adam and David fight about her.
Yeah, because yeah, David's like, why would you have done this, you know, to, you know, like, you're trying to break in,
she's
in the bathroom or something. All these, like, really awkward, like you said, it's like a child interaction thing.
Right.
And the more I talk about this, the more I'm starting to think this is a much better movie, actually. Eventually, you know, so David decides to cook her dinner, and it's a proper date, and it goes all the way, which is a bit incredulous, like, after 7 days of knowing this guy. I mean, you don't really get a sense, like, that part's not necessarily believable, but you can kind of, like, whatever, it needs to happen for the story, right. to play out, so it's a movie thing, whatever. And it doesn't feel so gross, you know, like, in terms of the, like that, she wouldn't sleep with this guy, knowing him for 4 days. But, I mean, in a weird way, she's seen him for 7 straight days straight, so he's had all this time. It's been like they've been on 7 dates or something, you know.
And she's single, and he brings out the curiosity in her, so you're almost like, it's more primal, I think.
Well, there's that, and then there's also just, like, that he's actually talking with her and about the things that she used to do and likes to do. So right. that when you, I think when you appeal to someone's actual passions, like, it brings out their passion, so... Mm-hmm. So that's, like I said, it's a bit incredulous, but I think they do enough to set it up that you're, like, not going to lose your shit over it, you know? Right. It's not like, oh my god, that's so unbelievable. So she and Joy and David end up sealing the deal, and Adam gets pretty upset about it the next day.
He watches them.
Yeah, he watches them, and but they don't see it, you know?
It's creepy.
Like, and that's when it's gone full on, like, yeah, like I said, as much as it's less of the, like, overt... like tension and thriller stuff of Ex Machina, it has a few more moments that are almost just more icky, creepy, especially towards the end when it really gets to that point. But it gets there rather while you're still sort of figuring out what kind of movie it is, and with these other kind of elements that I think are fairly authentic, almost romantic elements and just sort of tech stuff.
Well, and it's such a free area too. You know someone's going to get hurt.
Yeah, you know,
because he has access to them whenever, or at least to David whenever he wants.
Right.
So you know that something's going to go down. We already seen Ex Machina.
Right, yeah.
So you kind of think that somebody's going to get stabbed or choked.
Yeah, something's going to happen. And you've had the description of the strength of the robot. Or not necessarily of the robot, but David describes being when he was younger, when he was back at M&T, he designed like an arm for a robot that could, he said, could crush a pool ball or like hold a butterfly wing.
Right.
So you're like, okay, that is pretty... That's... Like, you know, foreshadowing, writing, whatever. And that gives you your tension right there. And you're like, okay. And then you get the sense, like, when Adam flips out about basically Joy staying the night and being, like, David's girlfriend now. And so there's this whole extra thing of, I mean, at one point David says to Adam, like, look, I've devoted so much of my life to you. Or so much of my... The way he says it is very key. Because he says, I've devoted... You know, I don't know, he doesn't say my life, but he says, the wording there is very important for later. I've devoted myself to you for so long now, you know, so the jealousy stuff, like, it's really good, because it's basically a romantic love triangle wrapped in this sci-fi thriller at one location with just a few practical effects. And so, at one point, it looks like Adam's going to maybe go after him, and so they sort of back away, and David's like, go, you know, like, go out the door and everything, and Adam jumps on David and tries to put, like, a drill up his nose or something, and you're like, what the fuck is
like
this?
Like a lobotomy or something?
Because he's trying to, I mean, this is like some Blade Runner creepy, like, yeah, like, right. Get into him, crush their head kind of stuff. And then in a way, another thing that seems incredulous at the time, but it pretty quickly gets written out, you figure out why. Joy then does the old, you know, knock the guy out with the vase from behind thing, and you're like, well, would that work on him if he's a robot?
Right.
So he's knocked out, and then David and Joy go running, and then David has a freaking aneurysm or something. You're like, well, that must have been from getting drilled.
Right.
And then Joy gets...
I think that's about when the time that it all started to click.
Knocked out. Yeah. Right. Well, that's about the time you start to be like, let's go. And then they make it very obvious visually when they fade up from the, you know, Joy gets chloroformed and she wakes up and she's kind of in a, I mean, it's like, it's turning almost into like a, I wouldn't say torture porn, but because that's not even accurate at all, but something like somebody's now tied up and now this is full on like creepy, scary thriller type stuff.
Right, right.
But this is, you know, with like 10 minutes left in the movie, you know, the 82 minute runtime or whatever it was. It was less than 90. What, I don't remember.
It was perfect.
Yeah, it was great. And you see, well, wait a minute, David's eyes are open, and he looks kind of, maybe it's the lighting or whatever, but he looks kind of artificial. And Adam's kind of just doing his thing, and he's, like, perforating holes in the abdomen of David, and, like, he's gonna get something out of him, and you're like, what kind of creepy shit is this robot doing to this guy now? And you almost think, like, he's gonna rip his heart out and give it to her, like, because of weird robot logic about love or something.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, I hope it's still good, you know, for your sake.
Or turn her into a robot or something.
Yeah,
yeah. Like that,
right? And then you see that he rips this thing out. It's a box. It's like a little box that looks like a bunch of circuit boards glued together or something. And you're like, okay, so he has that in him. But, I mean, at this point, I mean, pretty much I had started to figure that out. I figured that was either a possibility fairly, I wouldn't say fairly early, about a third of the way to the movie. I'm like, this is one possibility, is that it's just the old switcheroo. Uh-huh. And that the guy that she's interacting with, thinking he's a human, is actually the robot. And that the other guy is just the real guy, and has just got severe, not severe, but a pretty major social issue, you know, like mental whatever, you know, he's like much higher Asperger's autism. That ends up being the case.
Right. I thought they did a pretty good job of covering it up, because of the way that David talked to Adam, where he was always trying to teach him.
Right.
And called him buddy.
Yeah. No. It was, I mean, the whole thing was like, and this is where I think it kind of, like you said, in like the last 5-10 minutes, so you get the reveal, and then cut to Rainn Wilson as evil corporate guy talking about the NSA and using, you know, moving up to the next phase of the project. Mm-hmm. With domestic infiltration or something, you know, for like I guess the idea is that we'll make AI that are so convincing as people.
For like espionage stuff.
But he says domestic. He specifically says domestic, so it's more even creepier. It's not like you're going to put one of these guys as in, you know, plant them in a terrorist cell in Iraq. You're going to put these people out in the U.S. presumably to creepify, spyify, do whatever to U.S. citizens. I mean, it makes it extra cynical and weird. And I kind of could have done without it, because it's a little bit of a ham-fisted social commentary that they throw, a political social commentary they throw in there that just isn't needed. Uh-huh. It doesn't... It's, you know, it's like when movies, like you see a movie and then it throws on like a little like text at the end to be like, oh, remember that this actually happens in real life or something.
And right.
You, you know, like just
stat.
Let the movie end, you know, let it breathe. I mean, it's not super egregious, but it's like, it's hokey.
I could have done without the ending.
I could have done without that, the evil corporate guy, blah, blah, blah ending. I mean, it could have, it's enough just that it's somebody who doesn't understand what they're doing, like the ethical elements of that. You know, I mean, he even says at one point to David, who is actually Adam, just so we make it clear, that he's like, are you ready to serve your country? You know, like he's going to go be part of the NSA. And then this guy was talking with the Secretary of Defense, like they're old buddies and stuff. And so it's got that kind of good old boy, like evil conspiracy thing that they throw in there.
One thing I didn't like about the very end was both Adam and David were in the room talking to the main boss guy.
Right.
And I think the reason they did that is because they wanted to show that they were both robots, basically. Yeah. You know, that even though one guy created the other one, he was still a prisoner, just like, you know,
absolutely. David was.
And so I thought they did that pretty well. And
what? Yeah, and then you just get into like the real subtextual stuff of like the robot was, it's almost like through programming was able to become more convincing as a human than this other guy who, because of his mental issues and because of, you know, his autism or whatever, which they never explicitly say. I don't think they say that word once in there, which is nice. They don't feel like they have to lay out like a, like I don't think, one thing they could have done if they wanted to really dumb it down for the audience is they could have had the woman when she's talking on the phone kind of describing the guy as a jerk, describing David as a jerk, you know, who clearly, she could have gone into it like, you know, I don't know, I think he's got like some kind of autism, and she didn't even say that. Like,
She made him seem so smart that she didn't want to do the job because she felt that he was going to condescend her the whole time.
Right, which is different than like sort of describing to the audience, like getting that seed planted of like what that you know, mental issue is. Mm-hmm. They didn't even do that. They didn't have to do that for the audience. They didn't talk down to the audience in that respect and like stop and be like, oh, you know, we like Asperger's. Like, oh no, it means like this, this, and this.
Okay.
And then, like, okay, so now the audience is aware of that. I mean, it's like, it's all subtext and the robot becomes more human than him. And what does that say for him? And what is that, you know, but then he acts out and that's when things fall apart. But like, because he has this, like, you know, I mean, it's admittedly more creepy and less nuanced attraction to Joy, and he's not able to kind of, because he doesn't have the programming, right? Mm-hmm. Like, literally, figuratively, wherever you want to go, be able to, like, woo her in the right way. And he never would have been, because he's supposed to be the robot, according to her.
And that's how she looks at him.
And that's how she would look at him.
Yeah,
but
when he touches her, she's freaked out by it.
Yeah.
When he
tries
to kiss her at one point.
Well, that's towards the end. That's when the full freak out happens. Right. They don't do that too early, I think. They play all the interactions in a way so that it's not like something was so horrendous in the middle that you're like, she wouldn't go back there. Like, it's never...
No, it did get kind of weird. And another thing they did a pretty good job of concealing Adam was when he grabbed her knee and then squeezed it too hard and actually hurt her.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he didn't know his own strength kind of thing.
Yeah.
So they did have stuff like that. And then I think that's when he started to get a little bit creepy towards her.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. It was that. I mean, if you really look at it and really think about it, though, there's a few kind of odd oversights or maybe they're purposeful things in there where, like, I mean, if you just look at Adam versus David... David is clearly more what a robot would look like.
Yeah, and then the way he talks to, like you said, when he described how she was pretty, like, she'd logically fit what a pretty would be.
Right. I mean, the whole time you're like, that's believable for his character. And then later on, he starts using deadpan humor with her and being charming. Right. And you're like, okay, that's more human. He's actually got, like, complexity. He's not, if he's got, you know, autism or whatever, it's very, very mild.
Right.
And then later on, he's telling the story about, you know, the Japanese grandfather teaching sushi, but not teaching him, but he kind of observed it.
Right.
And you're like, that's like a pretty real, if he was in Japan, I mean, you could always implant memories, right? You know, and program it in.
Right.
Who's to say? I mean, you could nitpick that, but I'm not really going to, because there's an explanation for how he could have had that programmed into him, or memories of it.
Yeah, nothing was too gross as far as that goes. It was all, everything was pretty believable, pretty logical. And I even liked how, when they were playing chess and then David started going for the queen.
Right.
Because he almost learned something from, or Adam.
Yeah.
He'd learned something from David. So I think they did a pretty good job of reinforcing some of that stuff.
They definitely did. And yeah, I mean, just, I think that the thematic stuff it does... leaves you pondering much more because it adds an extra level. It adds that level of really like putting the mirror back on humanity, you know, in a way that's more than just sort of what I feel is a fairly generic kind of tried and true. Ex Machina is just like, man tries to play God and then the machine rises and kills the man, and right. You know, or manipulates the man in a way, you know, like a femme fatale. And you're like, okay, I mean... It was nice that the genders were reversed in Uncanny, you know, that it was a woman with a male robot. So you didn't have that whole, like, you know, covetous quality going on that you did in Ex Machina, which I think it was part of that story, you know, it was the fact that the guy got manipulated by, you know, kind of...
I think they had to do that for Ex Machina.
She
seems vulnerable behind the glass.
It was part of the plot, yeah. I mean, if you did a gender swap thing, like as a... thought experiment for Ex Machina, you could still make it work. It would be a little tougher to pull off, I think.
Yeah, because I don't think that woman would have that same compassion for a man behind glass, you know, because men are dangerous.
Right, exactly.
They need to be behind glass.
Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, there's a secret ending with, like, a little bit of credits that you didn't even catch, I guess, because you probably were like, hey, 2 minutes, boom, I'm done.
Right? I'm on to the next
one. Look, when I was starting to write my Letterbox review, where the secret ending, I mean, because... Joy ends up having sex with David, who is the robot, having robo-sex. And then later on, Adam explains, like, yeah, I made this. This is the prototype of the penis that I built for the guy when it seemed like you two were going to, you know, do your thing.
With the semen sack.
And then so she's checking a pregnancy test, and it's like, oh, my God. And it's like, you're supposed to be like, the one ending with the evil corporate stuff is kind of ham-fisted political stuff. And you're like, you don't need this, that's dumb. And then the secret ending with the woman pregnant is like, you can take it one of two ways. You can take it like, wow, that's like, what happened? Did the machine become real and make its own jizz? Like, I don't think that's where you're supposed to, that's not even at all what it is. What it ends up being is something far more upsetting and disturbing, which is that this guy kind of virtually raped her.
Well, yeah.
I mean, like
she was a sperm bank, so you were some sperm.
Yeah, I mean, it's like this guy, you know, put some of his own seed in the sack and put it on the robot, and so Adam, who still has kind of a fondness for Joy, obviously, is looking at a picture of her on his phone. Yeah, I think you could have ended that movie in a much more effective way. So like. And it would have been another 5 or 6 minutes shorter, too. Huh?
Right.
But up to that, I think it's good. I think that it's a real misstep, and I don't know. I almost feel like both of those circumstances feel to me like, especially the secret ending, being like a producer-director fight type thing. You know, like, oh, we both co-wrote this and I'm the producer and you're the director, you know, indie type of stuff. Right. You know, a handful of friends get together and make it happen. Like, I really think we need it. It's like, I don't want to do that, man. It's like, well, I'm saying we do it.
Right, right.
It's like, okay, fine. Then we'll put it at the end after the credits. Or whatever. And that was just, I mean, to me, that was a major misstep. That was a, I mean, it, because it does, it just sort of, like, you're using that as like an extra kind of dunt, you know, and it's like I don't know how I feel really much more gross about it. Whereas the way it ended, even with the corporate stuff, the way it ended before, there was this kind of tragic sympathy out for Adam. And but then you throw in, oh, but then he did this to Joy. You're like, oh, okay, I don't have the tragic sympathy anymore. I don't have that sense. It's just, it's much more gruesome. It's much more upsetting. And I mean, you could add that extra level of like cynicism to it. And yeah, so I feel like that really undermines a lot of the other stuff that the movie's doing, when the movie is much maybe subtler in a lot of ways, both of those endings. And that's too bad. Like, you know.
Yeah, I didn't see it, so.
You didn't see that part, but I mean, but you still saw the political ending, you know, which still works to make Adam.
They had to end it somehow. Yeah. They probably just weren't that, you know, good at writing, so they didn't know how to end it.
Well, no, they were good at writing because they set up decent enough characters and scenarios for it to hold your attention and everything else, and they did it in a quick and expeditious fashion.
They just didn't end it very well.
They were like, okay, well, I guess it's an evil corporate thing, and then okay, well, what if? What if when they had sex, she got pregnant? And like, well, how? And it's like, really stop and think about that. And the only way it would make sense is something that's pretty upsetting. And like, ick. So, I mean, now reviewing it, and I don't know, I'm not going to go change my Letterboxd scores, but I think I gave maybe Ex Machina like 4 or something on Letterboxd. I don't know. I think for the experience of watching it, it may maybe still a 4, and I think maybe I could give the other. I could give the other one a 3 or something. That might be because of the ending, like left me like what, you know, and so
right. That
took almost a whole star worth of quality out of it, and that's trouble. You know, a good movie with a shitty ending can really do it for you.
Yeah, I think Ex Machina, if you like visuals and you're a little more into the robotics of the AI and the robots are going to take over the world kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's Ex Machina is better in that sense, but as far as like a story and a little twist on the end, Uncanny, I think
in a weird way Uncanny, well, not even in a weird way because they got the practical stuff, I think Uncanny does more with the actual robotics and discussion of that than Ex Machina. Ex Machina has the one scene where he's like, oh, he shows his employee the shop where he built stuff, and it's like two minutes of that. There's not a lot into the actual construction and what he did and how the technology of the AI or the robot works, but there's a lot more of that in Uncanny.
Yeah,
even though they didn't have the... I mean, you know, you said it's a pretty... Ex Machina is a prettier movie.
Right.
It's showier, it's flashier, but it's more of a straight genre movie. There's not those... You don't get that element of... I think the characters are less developed.
Right.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
in the beginning of Ex Machina was really weird. Like, I didn't know what was going on.
With that, like, facial scan stuff that's happening at the very beginning?
Or that, or he's sitting in the office and he wins the contest and everybody's celebrating. Yeah. And then next thing you know, he's on a plane somewhere. Like, I thought it started out really bizarre.
Yeah, it just sort of threw you in, which I was okay with. Because you get it pretty quickly. You're like, okay, yeah, he's an employee, blah, 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 you know? But just that idea of, if you really want to start talking about, like, you know, water cooler, not even water cooler, but just like, you know, two people at the end of the day or whatever, like AI stuff. You've got the AIs take over the world, go crazy, manipulate us, we treat them poorly and they become, they revolt like the next slave labor or something and destroy us all. And it's like, that, well, that's been around for a long time. What about this more emerging idea of kind of socially, I mean, because like, I don't know, I mean, I don't know how long something like autism has even been in the medical journals or anything, but it's certainly become a bigger deal in the last 10, 15, 20 years. You know, people talking about this, you know, I mean, when did Rain Man come out? I don't know, but that was that too. and so then you've got this extra, this more complex level. It's like, well, human beings are not all the same kind of way. And like programming is one way. Like, can you program someone to be a more ideal human being than an actual person might be? And so the themes and the ideas are much there's much more there for you to actually think about and ruminate on after having seen that movie. And I think in a lot of ways what science fiction is supposed to do, what good science fiction is supposed to do, is do that. It's supposed to, of course, shine the light, shine the mirror on modern times and on these technological marvels as we push ourselves further forward, or backward, or evolve or devolve, right? And so, yeah, that's my last 2 cents on that. I mean, I think Uncanny is a superior movie in the end because of those things.
I think story-wise it did a lot better, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. I think I would give Ex Machina here on the podcast. I probably would give it a 3.5 out of 5.
Yeah.
So you're 3.5?
I would give them both probably a 3.5.
Yeah, it is hard to differentiate. I think I would too, because...
I mean, Uncanny's good, but it does lack the production value. The score isn't that good.
Right, yeah. But it's also subtly used for the most part, which I liked. Like, it doesn't insist on itself too much, as the way I remember. But,
It misses the ups and downs, too. Yeah. You know, like, Ex Machina, it does have that, you know, you feel claustrophobic, you feel scared sometimes, you don't know what's going on.
Right.
And Uncanny kind of misses that a little bit, but as far as the story goes, I think it was very well written. The characters were developed much better, and it was short.
Yes, all those things, like, yeah, shitty ending aside, all of those things like really do add up to a lot. So yeah, I mean, if I had to, yeah, I think they're both 3.5s for certain different reasons. I mean, I don't know. I would give, you know, Uncanny like a hard 3.5, and I would give Ex Machina like a light 3.5.
So Uncanny with the heart and Ex Machina.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm not going to go back to my letterbox and change anything. I refuse to change anything.